With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to a Halloween special of Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are...
Sir Patrick.
And James Hunt.
We'll discuss the latest comic book movie and TV news before launching into our spoiler-filled discussion of Stephen Norrington's 1998 film, Blade. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seven James to explain a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. Guys, keeping it horror-themed, can you explain Marvel Zombies to me?
Oh, God. A bad joke that got out of hand.
So, okay, just what happened was there used to be a term, I guess there still is a term, for someone who only reads Marvel comics. And, like, I was this person for probably 10 years. But basically, if you're a Marvel zombie, you just go into your shop, buy Marvel comics, and then leave.
Right, okay.
And, like, it's kind of a derogatory term for people who are obsessive about one thing and don't, you know, don't try anything else in the industry.
And kind of don't question what's in front of them, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
So then at some point, I can't remember when it started, it feels like it's been going on forever. You know, sort of mid-2000s.
I think it was earlier than that for... reasons, but go on. Say first.
Yeah, it might have been a bit earlier. But what happened was Mark Miller used them in his Ultimate Fantastic Four.
Yeah, they
run,
well,
isn't it? Yeah.
I think I have a feeling we should probably have looked this up and checked it, or it should be something we know. I think they first started doing it as a variant cover gag first, didn't they? Variant covers that were like pastiches with zombies, didn't they? But then what the Mark Miller thing was that he teased in his Ultimate Fantastic Four run that they were going to do a storyline that crossed over the Ultimate Universe with the regular Marvel Universe. And this was at a point when that hadn't happened and when they had always maintained that it was never going to happen, unlike now. So for the first couple of issues of this storyline, you thought that Ultimate Reed Richards was communicating with the real Reed Richards. And then the twist was actually that it was a zombie evil version of Reed Richards from a universe where basically all of the Marvel characters had become evil zombies.
Right, okay.
And then they decided to make a miniseries out of that world. And then they decided to do another one. And another one.
Like, as an idea, it's quite, you know, it's quite good fun. As one series, but they just ran it, like, seriously. If you can run any idea into the ground, they did it with this one.
Right, it had I mean, it ended up being pretty big. I mean, I don't know about the latest series, but the first series was written by Robert Kirkman, creator of The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Appropriate.
In fact, was it pre-Walking Dead? Because it's from 2005. When did Walking Dead start?
I think it was just after Walking Dead started. It was long before Walking Dead became, like, industry powerhouse Walking Dead.
Yeah, and it's drawn by Sean Phillips, who's fantastic. He's the artist on Criminal and various other things.
Yeah. Like, that first series is, you know, it's as fair a treatment as the concept as you can get. It's just every time they revisited it.
You've never seen something run into the ground as intensely as they have run it into the ground.
So it came to my attention because Seth Graham Smith, who somehow has been handed the keys to direct The Flash, he wrote a Marvel Zombies comic at one point, Marvel Zombies Return Hulk.
Isn't he also the guy who did Pride and Prejudice versus Zombies.
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, yeah, and Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, all that kind of stuff.
God, man, get a new shtick, seriously.
He is, he's going to direct The Flash.
So that'll probably have zombies in it as well. That'll be how they'll differentiate it from the TV show.
I mean, I'm just going to quickly do a list of all the Marvel Zombies series, just so you can see exactly what we're talking about here. I've just checked, it was September 2005 was the first appearance. So they were in Ultimate Fantastic Four, then they did Marvel Zombies, Marvel Zombies versus the Army of Darkness, Marvel Zombies Dead Days, Marvel Zombies 2, Marvel Zombies 3, Marvel Zombies 4, Marvel Zombies Return, Marvel Zombies Evil Evolution, which was a crossover with Marvel Apes, Marvel Zombies 5, Marvel Zombies Supreme, which I think was Chicken and White Wine, Marvel Zombies Destroy, and then there was a Secret Wars Age of Ultron versus Marvel Zombies, and that brings us up to 2015.
Okay, so let's move on now to take a look at some of the comic book, movie, and TV news for the past week. For this section here, it's just me and James. Through the magic of editing, Seb is departing us for this section, but rejoining us for the main discussion. But James, this week we got our first full look at the Jessica Jones trailer. And what did you think of it? It's our first kind of proper look at actual show footage of Kristen Ritter as Jessica Jones. Is it fair to say you're a little bit underwhelmed?
I'm not underwhelmed as such. I'm just... I've got a lot of trepidation about it because I love the comics so much, and it looks like it's going to deviate quite a lot from the things that I like about the comic, which are principally around Jessica Jones and how she's portrayed. So I didn't think it looked bad. I just think it looked different to what I want out of a Jessica Jones TV series, so I think I'm going to have to recalibrate my expectations quite heavily.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. We've spoken about this before, but we're quite clearly approaching this adaptation from different viewpoints because of Kristen Ritter, and I think you're still not sold on her particularly as Jessica Jones visually and now from the little you've seen of her performance, whereas I'm not expecting the exact same Jessica Jones from the comics, but I can still see Kristen Ritter delivering something fairly close to that. But yeah, does she still seem like a problem for you?
Yeah, to be honest, like that's the thing that is causing me to have a kind of disconnect with the material. It's sort of like she seems to be playing it as a kind of angry teenager, where maybe like that's just me getting old. And because I know she's what, early 20s, is it?
The actress, I think probably late 20s, to be honest.
Oh, really?
She was born in 81, so
so she's older than
me. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that makes me sound stupid then.
She's just very youthful and pretty.
Yeah, like I kind of get the feeling that Jessica Jones should be less overtly angry with the world than Kristen Ritter's version seems.
Oh, really? But Jessica Jones is always screaming in the comics. Like, she literally, whenever that kid comes to the office, she's always, like, just unloading on him.
But she's angry at herself, whereas... Yeah. Well, like, she's got PTSD in the comic.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel like what's happening in the TV series. Yeah. Like, I know they're clearly going for that to an extent, because they had her having the flashbacks and stuff, but her portrayal doesn't seem like someone in the grip of self-loathing like the comic version does.
It's interesting because I think we're just seeing opposite versions of the character from the trailer, and it might be that I'm just watching it through like rose-tinted spectacles and like seeing what I'm hoping to see. But I mean, the proof will be in the pudding. We're only a couple of weeks away now. What about some of the other stuff that you saw in the trailer? What did you think of Mike Colter's Luke Cage? Because he's not an actor I knew very much of, and so this was kind of the first real sense I've got of him.
Like Charlie Cox's Matt Murdock, he, like, as soon as he's on screen, you're like, oh, that's Luke Cage then.
Yeah,
like,
which I wasn't expecting at all. As soon as I saw him in the trailer, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that seems like they've got that bang on.
Yeah, like, there's nothing about him I can criticise from what little we've seen. Like, the thing that interests me is that he doesn't appear to be a superhero when Jessica Jones meets him.
I couldn't tell. I mean, I've only watched the trailer.
No, once, I mean, it's hard to say. It doesn't sound to me like he's got superpowers from what he's
saying. It's interesting. He kind of asks her about powers, so it's either that he is interested and kind of has discovered her powers, but maybe he is interested because he has them, but maybe he's just not, like, out as a superhero.
Yeah, I feel like even if he does, they're going to play it close to their chest, and then maybe if they reveal it, it'll be towards the end so that they can set up his series.
I guess if you're a viewer who doesn't know very much about the character, and then you kind of see, like, in the penultimate episode or in the finale, finally Luke Cage uses his powers.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully not to come to, like, the rescue of Jessica Jones or anything like that, because that would be horrendous.
Yeah.
But, it would be quite nice if he, you know, kind of, like, it showed his hand and then people are suddenly like, oh, now I'm excited for a show where that character is the main guy.
Yeah. I mean, his powers are very easy to do on the TV budget as well, so...
And it seemed to me, like, that, yes, Hellcat is going to be the direct replacement for Captain Marvel from what we saw. We only got a very brief flash of Carrie Anne Moss, so it's still not entirely clear what she's doing.
Yeah.
Luke Cage, it seemed to me like that maybe all of the love interests of Jessica Jones, or of Alias, are kind of being rolled into him in the show, that maybe don't expect to see an extra character plugging in for Scott Lang. Just expect to see a lot of Luke Cage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can see why that would make sense as well.
Yeah. And then the other notable thing about the trailer is that it is really heavy on Kilgrave, Purple Man stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something that Seb expressed a bit of worry about on Twitter and on emails between us, that it's talking about kind of like, he just hopes that it's not a full-on Purple Man series. And to an extent, I kind of agree with that as well, but I kind of think it will be, because Daredevil doesn't spend a lot of time worrying about people who aren't Kingpin in Daredevil, does
no,
he?
They do,
there's not
yeah.
any, like, story of the weeks or side plots. It's more of that classic Netflix, this is a 13-hour movie.
Yeah, I mean, my only criticism, really, of Daredevil, the TV series, was that I would have liked to have seen more sort of Matt Murdock in court case of the week, like, I think it was episode 2?
Yes,
where they
yeah,
did the
yeah,
whole
yeah.
court case episode. Like, I was geared up for seeing a lot more of that than we got. And I think that's going to be the same in Jessica Jones. Like, we might see one or two cases off the side, but pretty much everything she does, I think, is going to be tied into Kilgrave's return.
Yeah.
I mean, and to an extent, I'm fine with that, because, like, unlike Seb, I was expecting a series arc about Kilgrave. And, you know, I'm on board for that as well, because that's the Jessica Jones story. And if you're only going to do... Like, they don't know how many series they're going to do, so if you're going to tell the story, tell the story.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned this before, that I just think Alias really kind of builds up ahead of steam the further and further you get into it, and absolutely crescendos when it comes to, introducing the Purple Man and actually going through all that stuff.
Yeah, like, those first two arcs, like the Captain America and Rick Jones arcs, like, you know, they're fine, but
yeah.
The second half of Alias is where you're... You know, that's where it really got going.
And it, you know, similar to reminding me of the stuff that Daredevil did, Daredevil pretty much spent an entire episode flashing back to Foggy and Matt in college.
Wigs.
And, I mean, there's lots of potential for flashbacks in Jessica Jones in going back to the original Kilgrave incident or going back to her origin story, mm-hmm. which they're going to have to change. this secret origin of Jessica Jones, but yeah, there's potential for that kind of stuff in there as well. I do
hope we get a proper episode of her as Jewel, like in the costume. That's one of the things on my wish list for the series.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
I think they have actually cast a young Jessica Jones, so
okay.
we might be getting some kind of flashback at some point.
Interesting.
I don't know whether these, you know, names have all been confirmed now, but we kind of got, you know, the second episode is the penultimate episode is rumored to be called AKA Jewel and the Power Man. So there's also an episode called AKA the Come By a Circle Jerk, so and AKA Top Shelf Pervert.
Let's hope they're not being too literal with that then.
And AKA The Sandwich Saved Me. So, I'm still massively looking forward to this show. I think it's the comic book property full stop that I'm looking forward to most seeing at the moment. Like, besides any of the countless films in production.
Yeah,
I'm just excited for this.
I don't want to give the impression that I'm not... not at all excited or interested. Like, I'm...
A little bit trepidatious.
Yeah, I'm trying to manage my expectations, because, like I say, when me and Seb ran our old blog, which was Alternate Cover, which is still there if you want to go and find it, in 2010, we did a Best Comics of the Decade sort of discussion between ourselves, and we picked the 10 series we thought had been best, and unanimously we came to the conclusion that Alias was pretty much the best thing that Marvel or DC had done in the past 10 years. So, you know, that's the depth of affection I've got.
I don't want to do down the recommendations that you and Seb give me on the podcast, but I kind of, like, independently went and read Alias because you told me it was great. and this Jessica Jones series was coming. And it still is I think it's still the comic that I have enjoyed reading the most. To the point that it's 28 issues long and I've gone back and read it again and bought the hardback cover, you know, the hardback copy. And, yeah, I just absolutely adore everything about it. So, yeah, I'm just looking forward to this so much. Let's move on to our next piece of news now, and it's all TV news this week. and this is something I mentioned on the mini-sode last week, and actually broke just after we put out our X-Men First Class episode, which is that... Fox and Marvel have come to an agreement. We don't know why they've come to that agreement. Apparently it's not Fantastic Four rights. But they've come to an agreement that Fox can now make mutant TV shows. And this isn't going to be like a Wolverine Origins TV show. And it's not going to be like a an X-Men First Class TV show. It's going to be... We're going to get one called Hellfire, which has been developed for Fox... And we're going to get one called Legion, which is being developed for FX. And Legion is actually being showrun by Noah Hawley, who is currently showrunning the excellent Fargo TV series. I mentioned briefly what these are about on the mini-side, but Hellfire is going to be following a Hellfire Club in a 60s period setting, whereas Legion is following the X-Men character of the same name. So, James, do you want to add a little bit more context around what you think these shows could do or whether we should be excited for either of them?
Yeah, so we talked about how the Hellfire Club is quite a prominent organisation in the comics on the last podcast. So I can sort of see why you would do a story set in that sort of world.
Like, and it's kind of ripped off from the Avengers, the 60s TV Avengers as well.
Like, if I was doing a Hellfire Club TV series, for a start, it would be set in the modern day. And I don't understand why they're going back to the 60s, especially when they've explicitly killed off the members of the 60s Hellfire Club in the movie franchise.
But do we... I mean, we know it's going to be a mutant TV series, but do we know whether it's going to be X-Men canon? Because what if it's just not?
Well, yeah.
Or what if they just recast or just don't give a shit? Or what if it's set prior to First Class?
Again, all possible. But you would imagine if they're doing a mutant TV series based on existing characters, they're going to have some... Like, if you're doing a Hellfire Club TV series...
Sebastian Shaw and Emma Frost.
Yeah, if you're not using Shaw and Frost, why are you bothering, basically? Mm. So, like, I can see that they might...
I bet Kevin Bacon and January Jones are available.
I imagine so. But yeah, I can see why you'd build a story around, like, the power play and sort of backstabbing of that world. What I can't see is why you'd set it in the 60s, aside from the fact that it's all ripped off that one Avengers episode called A Touch of Brimstone, I think it was, where Chris Claremont saw that episode, stripped out the CIA elements and wrote them into the X-Men universe. And then now they're spinning them back out into the TV. Like, it's a bizarre path that concept has taken.
Yeah. What about Legion, which is being developed for FX? So, and you know, I spoke about Noah Hawley showrunning it. That's encouraging to me to start with. And then Legion, I understand in the comics, is Professor X's son, but they could kind of go either way with that with the TV show.
Yeah, I mean, it's very odd, because Legion as a character is kind of... They haven't done much with him until very recently, when he got his own series. But basically, his power is, like, he's super powerful, he's got multiple personalities, and every personality has a different mutant power.
Which seems like a great setup for a TV... It's Dollhouse, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, you can instantly see where that goes into a kind of power of the week... Encounter of the Week TV series. The problem is Legion in himself has never been interesting except as the son of Professor X. So they're going to have to rework the concept quite significantly, I imagine.
Or could you just ignore everything else and just go, this is a mutant and he gets a different power every week?
Yeah, you could, and like you could build a mythos around that, certainly. Whether it would be interesting to fans of the franchise, I don't know. But then, you know, statistically, there aren't that many X-Men fans compared to people who might watch it on TV. So, you know, no one's going to be upset that they're doing a different version of Legion because he's just not that sort of character.
And so, I mean, are you particularly sold on either of these shows? Or, like, anything...
If I had to watch either, I would watch the Hellfire TV show. I will watch them both, at least the first episodes.
Okay, well, I think that brings us to the end of our news section for this week. We'll move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of Blade when Seb will rejoin us. But before we dive in, let's listen to the trailer for the movie.
You better wake up. The world you live in is just a sugar-coated topper. There is another world beneath it. The real world.
For thousands of years, they have existed among us.
You keep your eyes open.
They're everywhere. Chances are you've seen them yourself and didn't know it.
A secret nation.
Our livelihood depends on our ability to blend in.
With a lust for power.
We should be ruling the humans. These people are our food.
They've got their claws into everything. Politics, finance, real estate.
There's a war going on out there.
He makes the weapons. I use them.
Now, one will lead them to conquer mankind.
Tonight, the age of man comes to an end.
We're gonna be gods.
And one will try to stop him dead.
There are worse things out tonight than vampires.
Like what?
Like me.
Half-human.
Blade's mother was attacked by a vampire while she was pregnant.
Half immortal.
You got the best of both worlds.
All our strengths, none of our weaknesses.
He is their greatest fear and our only hope.
It's open season on all vampires.
Okay, so that was the trailer for Blade. This is the 1998 Marvel movie directed by Stephen Norrington, written by David S. Goyer, and starring Wesley Snipes as the titular Blade. And guys, I think before we dive into it, I mean, and given that this is our Halloween special, I think it would probably a good place to start to actually look at vampires in Marvel comics, because I've read Spider-Man comics where, is it Morbius? Is he the vampire in Spider-Man that's shown up?
Yes, he
yeah,
is.
So I've kind of been aware of it, and I've heard about X-Men stories where Dracula shows up, and I know that Dracula is the villain in Blade Trinity as well. So how do vampires tie into the Marvel universe? Are they just there all the time, but only certain characters end up interacting with them?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, Marvel does have its version of Dracula, obviously, because he's, you know...
Public domain.
Public domain. Yeah. So they've got Dracula in there, and they've got a whole mythology built up around their version of vampires. It's not very interesting, to be honest. It's kind of...
They initially weren't actually connected to the Marvel Universe to begin with. They'd sort of... it depends how detailed we're to go in terms of... A history of horror comics.
All of the details. Give me all of the details. I love details.
Okay, so to give you a brief, this is something I was going to explain later under different circumstances, but we might as well get it out of the way now. So horror comics really started to get big in comics in the early 1950s because basically the superhero fad had died out pretty much with the end of the Second World War. And the new genre that came along that really took off in comics was horror. And this was predominantly down to a company called EC. And they published things like Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror, which you may well have heard of because of the film adaptations of them. Hmm. And for a good 5 years or so, they were the absolute biggest thing in comics. Like, those comics were as big as the biggest superhero comics had been in the 40s.
It's almost like The Walking Dead being the biggest show on television.
A little bit, yeah. And what basically happened was, in the mid-1950s, and this is far too big a story to get into, in fact, there's a whole book about it called The 10-Cent Plague that is massively worth reading. but there was a massive panic and scare over the influence that comics in general and horror comics specifically were having on children, largely led by an academic called Frederick Wortham. And essentially, in the mid...
Discredited academic.
Yeah. Actually, to be fair to Frederick Wortham, he changed his tune quite significantly much later in life, but the damage was done by then. The problem was that a lot of the reasons that he went after horror comics for, while they were great, were kind of valid in terms of how they weren't really suitable for children but were being sold to children. But the whole of comics were being treated as trash that was corrupting the minds of the nation's youth. And essentially, in the mid-1950s, the Comics Code Authority was set up and a set of guidelines were drawn up that basically, if publishers didn't agree to... their books would essentially be blacklisted and nowhere would sell them. And essentially, this had two effects. One, it basically drove EC Comics out of business because you basically couldn't publish any of the kind of stuff that they were publishing.
It was things like you couldn't use the word crime in the title of a comic. It was that draconian.
Yeah, and it sort of... It neutered comics for quite a long time afterwards, basically until everyone realised that no one was paying attention to the Comics Code anymore. But also what it kind of then had the side effect of was it basically revived the superhero genre because comics publishers needed to publish something else.
You couldn't do anything else.
Yeah, so that kind of led to, you know, the creation of Marvel and the revival of DC, but it led to the death of EC, which was a massive shame because basically all the most talented people working in comics in the 50s were working at EC. And actually DC had been publishing horror comics as well. They'd had a series called The House of Mystery, which ran in the 1950s. So horror comics basically died out in the 50s, but in the early 70s, the... like horror in general was becoming popular, you know, kind of in cinema and stuff. And the rules of the Comics Code began to be relaxed a little bit, like they could get away with actually publishing horror comics. So obviously EC were long gone, but DC brought back House of Mystery, and Marvel decided to kind of jump on the trend by starting to publish a kind of line of horror comics, one of which was a Dracula comic.
All right. Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah, The Tomb of Dracula. Yeah. And initially, it was entirely separate from the Marvel Universe, but gradually they started to fold it in. And it's still... He hasn't interacted much with the Marvel Universe over the decades, but he has popped in and out here and there. And Blade is the most obvious example. Blade was a character that was actually introduced in Tomb of Dracula as a supporting character.
Right.
And then who eventually became popular enough to, you know, to spin off on his own.
And so other characters, I mean, would it be right to assume then that kind of... think characters like Ghost Rider and Swamp Thing come out of that kind of era as well?
Definitely. I mean, Swamp Thing is absolutely from that tradition. I mean, like, some of the people, like Bernie Wrightson, who worked on early Swamp Thing, had been working on horror comics in the 70s. It's that mid to late 70s horror comics tradition definitely spawned things like Swamp Thing.
I mean, you were saying before we hit record, you were saying about how Howard the Duck was in the list of Marvel horror characters. That's because he first appeared in an issue of Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man Thing, because Swamp Thing's DC.
Man Thing, yeah. Whoops.
So, who are the biggest characters, kind of, that survive now or that are still popular now that came out of this, like, horror revival? I guess at Marvel and DC.
I would say it's probably... He probably is Ghost Rider and Swamp Thing.
And Blade, to an extent. But I think Blade because of the movies, though.
So let's move on specifically to Blade, because I've never seen him pop up in a comic, and I've never been... I can't remember the last time that I've actually seen, like, a physical Blade comic, and I guess they must exist, but, like, is Blade a character who has been published right now, or has he been recently, or...
He has been recently, but not really
big.
Because of being Blade, so much as... in about the last decade, a thing that isn't there in the movie, but that people have gone back to, is the fact that Blade is British in the comics. And that actually makes him technically Marvel's first British superhero, because he predates Captain Britain by a few months.
Is he from anywhere in Britain in particular?
He was born in a brothel in Soho.
That's awesome.
In the 1920s, was it?
Something
1910s?
Like that. Yeah.
The early 20th century.
Yeah, there's been a couple of instances where first in Paul Cornell's Captain Britain and MI13, which one of these days we'll find an excuse to recommend to you on the podcast for the sake of getting you to read that. And then more recently in Al Ewing's Mighty Avengers series, there was a character whose identity was a mystery for a few issues, and then it was revealed to be Blade, basically.
Right, okay. So he came out of this 70s thing. Was that his big period on the page? Was that when he was really popular on the page, or did he have a revival in the 90s that led to someone going, let's give Stephen Norrington $40 million to make a movie about this guy.
He basically started showing up in Ghost Rider, and because Ghost Rider was popular in the early 90s, there was that kind of brief revival of interest in the horror line.
Yeah, they had a whole line of books called Midnight Suns, which is all these like horror characters sort of forming an ad hoc team.
Because it does seem kind of bizarre looking back now and thinking, I mean, yeah, sure, we're now at the point in comics where you can like spin off one obscure X-Men character, or you can, you know, dig deeper into the Marvel vaults for characters, or you can set a film around the Guardians of the Galaxy or the Inhumans, but this was 1998 when, I mean, this is pre the superhero movie revival with X-Men and Spider-Man. So why were they making a Blade movie? It just seems like such an obscure choice.
I think, to be fair, the reason they made a Blade movie is because it wasn't really a superhero. Like, Blade as a concept stands alone fairly well. And this is during the era when Marvel were just selling off their rights to basically anyone to stay out of bankruptcy.
Right.
And from what I've read, basically, well, there were, as we mentioned, kind of early 90s, Blade at least had a bit of a resurgence. And from what I gather, it started to be developed as a film property because LL Cool J wanted to do it.
Right, okay. It's really interesting. You look at David Descoyer's screenwriting credits, so He'd written The Crow, City of Angels in 1996, and then in 1998 he had two superhero movies, two Marvel movies. One was Blade, which made it to cinemas. The other only made it to TV, and that was Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
the David Hasselhoff one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had The Crow, Nick Fury, Blade, Blade 2, and Blade Trinity on his CV before he got the Batman Begins gig, which is just astonishing. But yeah, well, I'm sure we'll talk a lot more David Escoria as we go through this podcast. So, guys, am I right in saying, am I right in thinking that none of us had actually seen Blade before we recorded, before we, you know, decided to do it on the podcast?
It's just because it's a genre that I just have no interest in whatsoever. And despite all the talk about it, yeah, I'd never seen any of the Blade films.
Yeah, see, even in the late 90s when I was like peak Marvel nerd, I was not remotely interested in watching a film about Blade. Like, that's the level of kind of popularity he has within the comics industry. Mm. Like, you can't give him away. One of the reasons that his identity was being kept a secret in Mighty Avengers was because that was the only way to make people buy a Blade comic.
See, I've seen Blade Trinity before, but that's it. So we're definitely going to have to get to Blade 2 at some point, because I think that might be the only Guillermo del Toro movie I haven't seen as well. So, and I'm fairly sure that's the most like critically revered. But yeah, so what did you guys think of it generally? Were you won round by the movie after having avoided it for so long?
I would say that it was about what I would expect from a movie written by the writer of Man of Steel and directed by the director of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Spoilers
I'm not sure
for
it was
two
better than either of them.
Spoilers for two of our future episodes there, Seb. Although I'm not sure people
I
will
haven't
be particularly
spoiled League
surprised.
Of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
What about you, James? Was it any better or worse than you were expecting?
I would say it was a lot worse than I was expecting.
Right.
Because people talk about this as like, oh, this was the film that turned it around for comics and showed that you can make a good film out of a comic book. Like, did it? Because it didn't look like a good film to me.
Well, I mean, I looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes. It's kind of like in the 50s, and the second one is slightly higher. I've got to say, that like, while I did find certain elements of this film inept, I kind of really did enjoy it, and I found elements of it to appreciate, and to me, it kind of seemed like I almost wish it was a film that I'd seen in the cinemas, you know, around that time, that I could have just gone and, you know, spent £5, because that's how much cinema tickets cost back then. Maybe not even that. And yeah, just got a big old bag of popcorn and just sat there and had a load of fun with it, because it was just, to me, just seemed like a really fun, throwaway, entertaining movie that
See, I kind
absolutely
of,
came out of the late 90s.
I kind of got the feeling that it didn't have much of a sense of humour about itself, and it thought that was kind of my biggest problem with it. Much cooler than it was.
Yeah,
like, it was striving very hard to be like, oh, look how badass and awesome this is.
Mm.
But it was just coming across really sort of needy and comically.
There was no wit about it, really. Sort of, it's just, and it's like not every, you know, comic book film has to be witty per se, but I think any superhero or superhero inspired thing that kind of tries to make out that at heart they're not inherently ludicrous, I think is on a bit of a hide into nothing.
To me, it didn't feel like a superhero movie in any way to me, though. It felt like a 90s star vehicle where let's put a badass action hero in the middle of things and let's treat him like he is the coolest thing in the world, which Wesley Snipes is pretty damn cool in this movie, and pretty damn cool generally, apart from when he's evading tax. But normally, Wesley Snipes is really cool, and it seemed like that kind of movie.
There's a couple of things on Wesley Snipes. Watching this, I found it difficult to believe that the Wesley Snipes of this and the Wesley Snipes of Demolition Man were the same person, because he's just got no charm or charisma in this film at all. He's just sullen.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Whereas you look at something like Demolition Man and it shows what Wesley Snipes is like when he's having fun in a film.
Mm-hmm.
And this might sort of actually be taking us into the narrative of the film, which you might not want to get to yet, but saying that it's not really like a comic book movie, the thing that really struck me was that about the opening 10 minutes or so, if you take out the fact that he's brutally murdering a load of people and it's incredibly violent, those opening 10 or 15 minutes are basically the opening 10 or 15 minutes of a Batman film. Aside from the fact that he's killing vampires, everything about how that plays out, how he arrives on the scene, how he acts, how he escapes from the police and climbs out of a vent, it's just, this is Batman. They have wanted to make a Batman film, but they don't have the rights to Batman, so they've done it with this vampire hunter. Now, admittedly, it does move away from that eventually, but watching it, it struck me how comic booky it felt in those opening scenes in terms of just going by the conventions of what tends to happen in the opening 20 minutes of a superhero film, especially in and before that era.
I think the opening 10 or 15 minutes were my favourite part as well. I really liked everything for about the first 15 minutes, yeah.
That was my least favourite part. Like, by the end of that, basically by the end of the nightclub scene, I was completely off board with the movie. Like, I actually enjoyed some of the later stuff more than that.
Oh, we're going to have a real fun podcast here. Well, should we talk about that opening then? So it starts off where we get this flashback to Blade's kind of origin, which, you know, like, we spend 30 seconds on, although there will be a twist, which is that his pregnant mother is bitten by a vampire, and he is kind of born while his mother is dying from this vampire bite. So he is born kind of half human, half vampire. And we hear people very swiftly referring to him as a daywalker. So while the whole mythology around him isn't, like, explicitly explained until probably about halfway through the film, I think we all get the idea. Half human, half vampire, but likes to hunt vampires. And then we cut to this nightclub scene, which is a nightclub run by the villain, Deacon Frost, Stephen Dorff, who we'll get to, where this kind of human guy has been lured there by a vampire, and it's pretty much a rave at which the sprinklers turn on and spray blood everyone, while vampire Donald Logue is sat at the side making out with one girl while another one gives him head. It's a really bizarre opening. I was kind of transfixed by everything. I think
that's going to stand for all time as the only blowjob in a Marvel movie.
Donald Logue, who showed up in Ghost Rider as well, and now is in Gotham. He's got a real sideline in dark but silly comic book properties.
I mean, it was just the moment when the sprinklers come on and they're full of blood. Like, I just thought, how can you take this movie seriously if it thinks that is that's in any way cool or threatening or whatever? I don't know what effect it was trying to achieve.
I thought it was cool. Like, I thought it was like a really
stupidest thing I've ever seen.
I thought it was a really cool, twisted, like visually twisted.
Really, it was. Like, if I'd seen it, if I'd seen it in From Dusk Till Dawn, maybe. But that film had set itself up as having a sense of humour, whereas this one had not.
No, but that is the film setting up its kind of MO within the first couple of minutes. I liked all the early silliness, and the kind of later when it got bogged down in the plot, that was when I was a little bit less excited. But see, I kind of liked that it was all a little bit kinky. Like I said, that Donald Logue is getting head in the side, and like most of the female vampires are dancing around in kind of in their bras, and there's this weird guy.
It was so teenage. It was just like the first thing you think of, like, you know, how can I make this rave scene seem edgy? Oh, people are having sex. There's blood in the ceiling. Like, okay, like, you know, this is a good story, but you know, don't hand it in to your teacher.
Fair enough. But then Blade turns up. And Blade basically goes around showing you all of his different types of weaponry and taking out vampires in various inventive ways. And another thing that I quite liked about this film is that Wesley Snipes seemed to be doing most of his stunts himself, and there was quite a lot of carefully choreographed action, and I actually thought all the practical effects were pretty cool. Like, I thought the blood showering down on them looked good, and I thought some of the actual fighting and stuff looked pretty impressive as well. When the CGI takes over, less so.
But there's one particular moment right towards the end.
Yeah. We're all thinking of it.
Yeah, which was almost a lot worse as well.
Yeah.
So I really liked Blade turning up and kicking ass, and I like I say, I've had such a little. Maybe it's that I watched Blade Trinity and just didn't find Blade cool at all. That I was kind of stunned by how much I did like Wesley Snipes here, and just thought like everything about his costume, with his half-shaved head and his tattoos and his tiny little glasses and his bulletproof armor and all that kind of stuff. I just thought he looked cool.
This is the kind of thing that, like, can you imagine, like, Blade's supposed to be, like, this, you know, super competent vampire hunter. Like, how much time does he spend on his personal grooming? Like, is that all he does when he's not hunting vampires? He's like, I've got to go and get my haircut touched up. Like, I need some cooler tattoos because these ones are fading a bit.
I think Whistler just does it all for him while he's getting his serum. Chris Christopherson's, like, Whistler. So, amazing.
That's what I mean. Like, it was so kind of needy in how it wanted to stand out and look cool, that it spent more time on looking cool than being cool.
But he turns up and kills all the vampires.
Yeah, well, what he does, actually, he turns up and poses a bit and then gives a speech and then kills the vampires. And he does that a lot.
He does it in full-on 90s movie star way, which is, hey, look, Wesley... Because no one was turning up to watch a Blade movie. People were turning up to watch a Wesley Snipes movie. It's, hey, here is Wesley Snipes. Look at how cool he looks. And now watch him kick ass for a bit and occasionally quit.
Like, I think
that's fine, but I didn't go to see it.
Yeah, I think if that's something that you want to see from a film, Wesley Snipes doing martial arts, then great. But to be honest, that hits on what maybe my biggest problem with this film is that two genres of film that I'm probably the least interested in are horror and martial arts, so put the two of them together and yeah, I'm not really bothered.
Okay, well, I'm gonna guilt you both into saying something positive about this movie now, because I'm gonna play the race card. Isn't it really great that we had in the late 90s a black movie star playing making a black comic book character prominent? And the fact that the movie then casts the female lead as black as well, and that there are various characters that kind of show up around the background of the film as well, it's quite a racially diverse movie. And then they make all the heroes black apart from Chris Christopherson, and all the villains white. And
apart from Blade's mum.
Yes, well, yeah, but she was a hero turned a villain. So, but yeah, we haven't seen that happen again since Blade, which...
I mean, it's actually pretty appalling that the last
Blade
comic
was the last
book
time
movie...
It happened,
yeah, with a black lead was Blade Trinity. It's just... It's just stupefying.
Yeah, really. And it's not like it didn't make its money either.
Well, yeah. Exactly. You know, this is the... I mean, essentially, and something we haven't really talked about in terms of context, but this film kind of is probably the thing that started off the process of saving Marvel from bankruptcy, isn't it?
By proving that their property has had some value.
Yeah, it's what enabled probably X-Men to go on and get made. And I mean, you know, this film comes from a point where Marvel were basically dead.
Yeah, they were probably in Chapter 11 at this point, even.
Yeah, so I mean, I can at least give it an awful amount of credit for that. It's like other people obviously loved it, even if I don't. But actually, you know, the fact that it made so much money and was such a big hit should surely be evidence that you can take a black lead superhero character and put him in his own film and people will go to see it. It really is
an indictment, isn't it? And I'm just looking that they were like the... Yeah, so what you said about LL Cool J being interested and that... when Goyer actually got, you know, some backing to get the film going, they were looking at either Snipes or Denzel Washington or Lawrence Fishburne. So, like, around then, there were big movie stars who were black who could, you know, there were big movie stars to choose from for this role. Mm. And, you know, the fact that nothing has happened since...
You've still got Lawrence Fishburne and Denzel Washington and Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, they are all still around. Wesley's out of jail again as well, so that is so that is nice. He's back available in The Player on NBC. but yeah, it shouldn't be something that you want to heap praise on a film for doing, because it shouldn't be this surprising. But I was pleasantly surprised as well that the female lead was black as well, that it wasn't just...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just like, because I bet it would have been so easy to put a pretty blonde alongside him. I don't know what happens in the sequels. Well, Ryan Reynolds and Jessica Biel are in the third one, aren't they? So that's what happened two films down the line. That's say something nice about the film, guys.
No, yeah, that's I completely agree with that. Like, it's embarrassing.
I do actually have other nice things to say about
it's embarrassing that it's been 17 years. And that's, you know, it's still one of the few around.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so should we talk about Karen, who Blade meets in the next scene when he goes to the hospital? It's something that the film doesn't really draw attention to, but the fact that Blade decides to kill Donal Logue in a... He actually says, I'm bored of, like, staking everyone, I'm going to burn you instead. So decides to burn Donal Logue to death, except doesn't get to finish it in time and has to leave. So Donal Logue doesn't fully die, ends up at the hospital where he bites one guy who eventually is transformed into a vampire, and also bites Karen, who is going to be our co-lead for the rest of the movie. And that's all Blade's fault. for him being a little bit too arrogant, and the film never really draws attention to that. Like, and I was reminded of it again later in the film, where Blade decides he will take on Deacon Frost, and Deacon, as a result, just throws this little girl in front of a bus. And Blade, like, literally, he goes after Deacon before he tries to save the girl. It's only after he's like, "Oh no, I can't catch her." He is a bit of a dick, isn't he? Second week in a row, we've got a bit of a dick as the lead of our. In fairness,
like in the comics, one of Blade's traits is that he's kind of single-minded about killing vampires to pretty much the exclusion of everything else.
If that was the case,
he should have just polished off Donald Wright's character's name is straight away. The fact that he dithers over it is the problem.
Well, it's kind of like he relishes it. It does drive it home, like that he's kind of like he does kind of enjoy doing this, and he really wants to inflict pain on the vampires while he's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's in character for him to kill a vampire rather than save someone. Like, he'll kill good vampires if he gets half a chance.
Oh, that's interesting. And he does. He does deliver one of my favourite lines of the film, and this is why I'm not sure that I think the movie does take itself seriously the whole way through. Like what bogs it down for me is the plot being so kind of standard, like vampire tropey, and oh, there's going to be this big prophecy, and we need to do this and this to fill in the thing, and you need to do this and this.
It's a good job it came out before Underworld. I'm saying that much.
But yeah, it was one of my favourite lines is him, like when he goes to the hospital to finish off Donald Logue and meets Karen, and the hospital security turn up and they start shooting at him, and he just goes, "Motherfucker, are you out of your damn mind?" I was giggling for a good 30 seconds after he said that. I was like, yes, this is the film I want to watch. I want to watch Blade getting angry and being cool and taking down vampires. But instead, he saves Karen's life. He decides that even though she's been bitten, he's going to save her. And luckily, she's a hematologist.
Yeah.
So it's one of those moments in the film where it's like, okay, who are we going to team him up with? Oh, so, hematologist? Can we do that? Yep. She's an expert on blood, and she's going to be teaming up with the vampire in this movie. What did you think of her, guys? Were you a fan of Karen? She's played by Nbushe, right? I could be absolutely butchering that name.
I mean, she was pretty two-dimensional, to be fair, wasn't she? Wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's there, and there's nothing particularly bad about the writing or the portrayal, which in this kind of film isn't necessarily a given. So we should be thankful that, you know, apart from that one incredibly euphemistic scene with the biting, the scene that basically sort of takes the place of what would be your standard love scene at that point in the film. You know, there's nothing particularly sort of badly done about her portrayal. She's just not particularly interesting.
I mean, I was spending the whole film going like, oh, please don't fridge her. And they didn't. So, yeah, to their credit, she lived to the end.
And you know, she plays a significant role in, like, actually seeing the plot through to its conclusion.
Well, yeah, she is responsible for the weapon that Blade uses to eventually win. And I think this is a film where you can accuse it of writing a role for a woman that she doesn't have, she doesn't have anything to do, or she doesn't, or she's written particularly badly. I think it's a pretty decent role that might be at times a little bit too much in service of the plot, but otherwise
it also kind of, I mean, she does get kidnapped towards the end, but it's never too sort of only having her be there to be damsel in distress, and she has a decent amount of agency aside from Blade. It's like her plot kind of ends up deviating from Blade, because you have this whole thing where, you know, she's trying to cure herself and she offers him the opportunity to cure himself, but then he actually doesn't want to do so, and they kind of part ways at the end. And it's sort of, you know, while her story is sort of inextricably linked with Blade's to begin with, she kind of gets her own conclusion and gets to sort of go off at the end of her story. I mean, I'm presuming she's not in the sequels. I don't know.
I don't think she is, no.
But it's, yeah, and actually, so yeah, I mean, like, as a character, she's not too reliant on the lead. You know, the story gets to be about her and how she solves her problem as well. And so actually, yeah, I was a little bit down on it just in terms of I don't think she kind of says anything particularly interesting or is especially, you know, kind of well written or anything. But, you know, again, it's small victories, but for a film like this to do that with a female character, and it's not something that Goya always has a great track record for. It doesn't always have a bad track record for it, but doesn't always have a great track record for it. So, you know, credit where credit's due, really. But I do kind of wonder, actually, if while not finding her massively interesting, if the film had been better being more from Karen's perspective, because I just don't think Blade works very well as a lead. There's nothing you can really hang on him.
Like,
and I think you need to be seeing him from the outsider's perspective, you know, for him to be this kind of aloof, cool guy.
We criticised, or I criticised her for being sort of two-dimensional, but Blade's kind of one-dimensional, isn't he?
Yeah.
Like, he's fighting in one-liners and killing vampires. Like, if there's any kind of subtext there, or any hidden depths, like, they're well hidden.
I don't know. I got a definite kind of underlying sadness from Wesley Snipes' performance. Like, this kind of, yes, he is introduced as this kind of, like, badass, quipping vampire killer. But the more you kind of, like, see him when he's not fighting and hunting vampires, he seems like there's just a real kind of underlying, yeah, like, melancholia to the character. And that's all tied in with what happened to his mother and the fact that he is kind of, he is the thing he hates and the thing that he despises. And then when you do get that twist at the end, it's not a particularly interesting plot twist, but it's a kind of a tragic one for that character. And I actually found myself feeling for Blade quite a lot during that last 20 minutes where he's going through the, you know, the meeting his mum and the sacrifice and all that kind of stuff.
I get what you're saying, but I think just by that point, I had long since before then stopped caring about what was happening in the film. Something I really struggled with. I just, the stakes, no.
Oh dear. Oh,
that wasn't deliberate. I didn't get any sense of the stakes of the film, and it just, you know, it's going through the plan and they're doing their ritual and it's just all, I think probably actually part of the problem is sort of the plan, the evil plan, doesn't really have anything to do with Blade. I mean, I know they kind of, there's something about, oh, his blood is key to it or whatever, but it just seems, I suppose it is connected to it in that sense, but it just seemed a bit too, but that,
yeah, I know what
separate.
You mean. It doesn't play into him until later. It's more that Blade is a vampire hunter who has crossed Deacon Frost by attacking his
yeah,
club.
That's the thing. It's like Deacon Frost has this plan where he's destroying all the old guard of vampires and becoming a new sort of super powerful strain of new vampire.
And it's almost a coincidence that it happens, yeah, that after,
exactly,
those two have crossed paths.
That's just happening at the same time as Blade just happens to be going after him just because he's an evil vampire. He's not going after him to stop that plan. He's just going after him to go after him. And it's, so the two storylines just don't really, whenever you cut back to Deacon and Deacon's got all of his stuff going on with what he's doing with the other vampires, which incidentally is, I mean, we'll get on to Deacon, but that's, I think that's some of the better stuff in the film. That just has no relation to Blade. And every time they cut back to that, it's like that plot has not moved on what is happening with Blade one iota.
It does, you know? It does feel sort of like Blade should have been going after him because it was him who killed his mother,
yeah,
rather than it.
Yeah, that's thrown in there as a line towards the end, isn't it? And you go kind of like,
what?
Well,
really?
Well,
okay.
Well, no, I just kind of went, well, I'd figured that out 5 minutes into
the
film.
I was kind of expecting that because who else was it going to be? Like, you're not hanging that out there and not resolving it. It's like when the serum is thrown to one side and the camera follows it over and you're like, I wonder whether that will be important later. Talking of Deacon Frost then, so Seb, you were saying that some of the stuff you enjoyed a little bit more. So do you kind of mean like the rivalry between Stephen Dorff's Deacon and the kind of the pure blood vampires who I liked how quickly it set up this idea that so Udo Kier plays Dragonetti, which is very on the nose casting, but well done, Stephen Norrington. It works. Udo Kier plays this kind of probably the head of this old guard of vampires who are all purebloods, which means they were born vampires, whereas someone like Deacon was transformed. And they kind of have this, like, they kind of liaise with the human world to an extent.
Yeah, I think they kind of maintain a status. I quite like that they sort of just maintain a status quo. It's like, we can rule the world by doing so the way that people rule the world.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to just go out there feasting on humans at night. We'll just, you know, we'll have all this power and money and do it. That, I quite like that, and I quite like the sort of... Because actually, as well, you would. It's a nice flipping, because you would expect in a story about... If you've got a story about an old guard and an old order of vampires, and then a new, younger one who's, you know, wasn't born a vampire coming along, you would kind of think it would be the other way around, that the new upstart would be going, hang on, you don't need to be going out there killing people, we can rule the world more insidiously. I quite like the fact that Deacon has just got this old-fashioned thing of, I just want to go out there and kill people and enslave humanity. You know, and he's the young upstart for thinking that. I quite like that. Yeah.
And what did you think of Stephen Dorff? He spends a lot of time with his shirt off, which is ambitious in a movie where Wesley Snipes also has his shirt off, and Wesley Snipes is about triple the size of him.
Yeah. He does seem to be pretty much the only person in the film who's having any fun, and I think that's why I liked him and liked that character.
He bites the neck of the cop who's been helping him out, and kind of just slathers the blood over his face while he's doing it, and then turns around and makes out and starts licking the blood all over over that Spanish vampire girl's face. It was just absurd. It was really fun. And so, I don't know what he was quite playing, Stephen Dorff. It was kind of like an extension of the, like, Gen X early 90s slacker, if he'd become a vampire and just didn't give a shit and was like, but you're right, it was really fun. It was less fun when he was having to deliver dull expository dialogue, but
yeah,
most of the time.
Something I would like to actually touch on briefly, because I've been reminded of it now, so it's a good point to mention it. While I'm talking about clever subversion of what you would expect from vampires, I do not like that this film contained a moment, as all vampire things seem to, where someone carefully explains which bits of what vampires are vulnerable to law are work and which ones don't. And that's okay. I mean, you do always get that, but what annoys me is when they do it and they act as if you're stupid for believing some of them, even though some of the other ones are true. So it's like, you think they're vulnerable to crosses?
Yeah.
Oh, but they are vulnerable to garlic.
Yeah.
It's like,
garlic has both
and
silver has
and steak through the heart and sunlight. So you're basically there, but that other thing, you idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't even bring up bodies of water. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So getting back to Deacon, this plan he has, which involves Blade's blood.
I'm not going to pretend to understand it, to be honest.
Yeah, he wants Blade's blood to fulfill some kind of prophecy, and that will turn him into the blood god, and then something. It's when actually talking about the actual plot of this film that I can completely buy into everything that you didn't like about it. That doesn't mean anything, does it? And I really don't care. And you're right, like, it does seem like an Underworld plot.
To be fair, I think Underworld lifted some of these scenes. Like, I genuinely can't remember, because it just feels so generic. The bit where he's, like, imprisoned and there's blood dripping into a sigil or whatever, I'm fairly sure that was in Underworld. It was definitely in Buffy.
What I do quite like is that, because this is a film from the late 90s, he uses computers to work out some of the arcane stuff to do with the plot, and that's seen as different and revolutionary, and nobody really trusts it as a method. I always like that. And terrible computer interfaces in mid to late 90s films are always good for a laugh.
Yeah, this is straight out of the Hackers and Johnny Mnemonic school, isn't it? I was reminded of Blade. I was reminded of The Matrix quite a lot watching this, but Matrixy, and it's interesting they came out a year earlier.
But it is that incredibly late 90s, slightly. I mean, it's not. in most senses, you wouldn't call it a cyberpunky film, but the way that Blade dresses and the way that Stephen Dorff's character is, it is very
and
much.
And sometimes
in
when
that,
the score
that
kicks
quite
in
narrow
in the
period
scenes.
Of time when you had all of those. Yeah,
it has that feel to it.
Incidentally, as well, talking about the way Blade dresses, I love that there is a whole scene where just in broad daylight on the street, Blade is walking around with these, you know, with his costume and his armor and his swords on his back, and he's just beating up a cop, and then he's pointing a gun at somebody, and just nobody notices. Everyone's just walking around on this street. I think it's in LA.
I thought for a second, is he invisible to humans? I genuinely thought that.
It's just like, maybe it's a deliberate thing that it's in LA, so nobody cares, and they just think he's an idiot in a costume. I did just think it was.
You know. I like the bit where he's like pointing out the vampires who are like across the street from him. And it's like, if any of them turn round, he's screwed.
But yeah, so when Blade does eventually get to this face-off and his blood is used and stuff, what did you make of the final showdown? Because it went back to some of the stuff that I liked again, which was Blade kind of being badass and some close-up fighting. And like I say, the fact that it all felt like it was Wesley Snipes doing it all himself was a real benefit to me. But the fact that he's facing off with Deacon as this blood god is just...
It's the CGI, isn't it? Like, that's what ruins it.
It's horrendous. I mean, and like I say, I really like the practical blood in the bloodbath scene at the start. And then by the end, you've got this CGI blood trickling down things. And it does, you know... And then Deacon Frost turns into a character who becomes...
It turns into the Lawn Mowman.
Yeah, that's it. That is exactly it, isn't it?
I mean, I don't want to be incredibly unfair to Stephen Norrington, because one day we're going to do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
And that'll be the time to be unfair to him.
Incredibly unfair to him. But there's... Aside from the fact that it's all, you know, very moodily lit, I don't think there's a lot that's that visually stylish about this. I mean, some of the kind of practical... There's some horrible, horrible... gory bits, and they're very well done in terms of being kind of schlocky and all the kind of practical effects, but stuff like the kind of the action sequence at the end, and there's a really terrible car chase scene that's got like, it's shot in this really weird, deliberately sped up way. It's relatively early in the film. I think it's Blade's chasing after the cop who's making the delivery, and it's just really, and it's just like, it's a bit sort of like he's trying to do something cool and music video-y, and it just, oh, it really doesn't come off at all.
I mean, it's...
I don't know if you know the bit I'm talking about, but because we're all just sounding blank, but...
I think I kind of know what you mean, but it goes back to me for this kind of like that everything that felt like it was doing when CGI was coming into play, I found really disappointing, because I thought there were some other really, really interesting and inventive stuff that Stephen Norrington was doing. And I don't want to speak to the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and how to blame he is for that film, because I've watched it once years ago and couldn't tell you where the fault lies with that. But I actually thought that a lot of what Norrington was doing was interesting. And I was reading Roger Ebert's review of this from his original release. And his first kind of, like, his introductory paragraph and first paragraph are really interesting. I'm just going to quote from them here, because he says, "At a time when too many movies are built from flat TV-style visuals of people standing around talking, movies based on comic books represent one of the last best hopes for visionary filmmaking. It's ironic that the comics, which borrowed their early visual style from movies, should now be returning the favour." And then he goes on to say that... Blade is a movie that relishes high visual style. It uses extreme camera angles, bizarre costumes and sets, exaggerated shadows, confident cutting between long shots and extreme close-up, and slams ahead in pure visceral imagery. And for half of the film, I kind of really agree with everything that he says there. But yeah, there is also just like, it can cut from something really cool to something just... horrendous. And it seems to me like I mean wasn't Norrington a first-time director at this point? I'm not sure, but a kind of a young director who maybe had a lot of balls and a lot of ambition, but maybe just didn't quite know how to pull everything off or pull everything together.
He's clearly got some kind of images in mind that he translates very well, but then when it comes to the actual storytelling, like, it's things like, if you have a shot of Blade posing with his sword, that looks cool. But when he's actually fighting, it's not always easy to follow. Like, sometimes it's just a load of limbs flying everywhere. Like, I kind of feel like...
Mostly Donald Logue's limbs, to be fair.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's just like He's got the vision, but not the ability to translate that vision completely.
And interestingly, so for that final showdown, and this comes directly from Wikipedia, so it could be completely false, but I don't think it is, the film was originally 20 minutes longer, and that they had heavy edits and reshoots, mostly... that the final fight between Blade and Deacon was replaced. So that sword fight that we get didn't exist whatsoever. To start with, Deacon Frost turned into Lamagra, which I think was the Blood God, right? That's the same. That was the same thing. Yeah. He actually physically turned into it and became a large swirling mass of blood instead of keeping his form. And that it was scrapped because they couldn't get the special effects to look quite right. That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of the film could have been scrapped from not getting the special effects nice if quite right.
It would have been nice if they'd been that discerning for the rest of the movie.
I don't know if you got... I got the sense from a lot of that kind of stuff that... I mean, and I even kind of feel this now, having not seen the film, but there was enough I liked about it and enough potential that I can imagine if I'd have watched this film and then found out 6 months later, oh, Guillermo del Toro is directing the sequel, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I can see there being a big marked improvement in the sequel, but also, like, there's enough about it that I like in the first place for me to want to watch a sequel. And I kind of really want to watch Del Toro's Blade 2 now.
Nah. Well, I kind of... I can see why you might, but no.
I think the only thing that interests me in the second one is the fact that Danny John-Jules is in it, and the only thing that interests me in the third one is the fact that Parker Posey is in it.
The second one has a really good cast. I mean, Kris Kristofferson apparently is back. I don't know how that works. Ron Perlman's there.
Well, actually, we didn't really talk about Whistler, but I did quite like Whistler. Although... I was convinced that because of the fact that they, when he first appears, they're listening to Bad Moon Rising by Creedence, a song which is so notable for its appearance in American Werewolf in London, I thought he was going to turn out to be a werewolf. And I was like, that song's not associated with vampires, that song's associated with werewolves.
Well, I take it, other than Blade, would I be right in thinking that probably Deacon and Whistler are... Marvel characters as well?
I don't know, because I haven't read enough comics with Blade in them.
No.
I would imagine that he must come from... was created for the film and then he's been worked into the comics later.
No, he was... the first thing he was in was the Spider-Man animated series.
Wow, that's fascinating. Wait, so he was created the Spider-Man animated series?
No, this is Wikipedia, but he was created for the film, but he was used in Spider-Man the animated series and that came out first.
Oh, really? I mean, that makes sense, but...
Yeah, because I think because they'd written the film so many years before.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, yeah.
But actually, no, he hasn't been in the comics yet, which is interesting.
Okay, but...
I mean, it's not that interesting, because he's just Microchip, really, isn't he?
But Deacon definitely has.
Yes. I think you're going to catch me out here. I'm pretty sure Deacon Frost existed separately from Blade...
He's from Tomb of Dracula. He actually predates Blade.
Okay, wow, okay.
In Tomb of Dracula, yeah.
But yeah, like, he's one of those characters who would have been in the license just for appearing in the same comics. So they could have made Dracula the villain, but obviously Deacon Frost is slightly more interesting.
He doesn't predate him. He post-dates him by a few months.
Okay.
But he appeared independently of him, I think, is the thing. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to know all this stuff.
Well, it comes back to the problem of Blade has never really worked in comics.
So it's going to make the recommendations section fun.
But I mean, do you think he necessarily... I mean, because Wesley Snipes has talked recently about how he's like spoken to Marvel and that there might be a chance of him being reintroduced in some way. And I mean...
Is that not just because Wesley Snipes needs the work?
Well, yeah, I mean, probably. I mean, because when I heard it... I mean, we've never stuck that into the news section on the podcast, just because when I heard it, I was like, yeah, that's Wesley Snipes saying it, and I'm just not at all convinced. I mean, I could see... But having said that, I could see a way that, given that Blade is a character who has some cultural cachet because of these three movies, that... there could be a way to rework him back in. I mean, Netflix would seem like an obvious kind of place
for a
series. I'd be interested if he did that, because those films are popular. So, yeah. You know.
But, I'm just not sure whether introducing Blade, like Wesley Snipes' Blade, into the current Marvel Cinematic Universe
tone of the movies, isn't it? Like, the tone of the movies is so far away from what Marvel would allow on their licenses to do on screen now. Mm. Like, they... You're right. They could do it in a Netflix series, but they emphatically could not do an MCU Blade movie because it's just too off-brand.
Well, it would, or it probably also end up looking like, you know, Ghost Rider 2 in terms of, you know, like this is this concept, but this is as much as we can do with it, because this is an 18 rated movie, and we talk about like Donald Logue, you know, getting head in that opening scene, but like there is a lot of like weirdly. Like, I mean, it's a vampire story, so there is going to be some kind of kinky sexual stuff. But, like, the moment when Blade's transformed mum was kind of rubbing her lip up against him while she was putting him into a big container that was going to, like, bleed him out.
That was the only moment I felt sorry for Blade. It was like, oh, man, it's got so weird for you. This isn't what you signed up for.
Do you know what I mean about in that final act feeling really bad for the guy? Like, I was like, I genuinely did have the feels for Blade. He was just about to have his wrist slashed for this ancient ritual, and he just found out his mum, who he thought was dead, wasn't actually dead. She's a vampire, and now she's licking his face.
Yeah.
None of that is pleasant. But what do you think of the 18 rating in general? Because, well, I mean, we're not going to get many comic book movies that are 18 rated. I mean, we'll probably get like a handful here and there. Do you think it made the most of it? Or do you think it justified it? Because I think it kind of felt right for the movie that I was watching.
I would say, like most 18 rated films, it appeals to a wide demographic of 13-year-olds.
I think it's just, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of quite impressive gore, but I'm not really a gore fan. So, and what the heck was going on with the big fat lad?
That was a
horrible,
woman.
Weird scene. Was it a woman?
Yeah, I think Pearl.
No, because I thought it was a woman, yeah. But then they said he towards the end of the scene.
I think
scene.
They did say he, yeah.
Yeah.
That confused me, but yeah. You know, but I think there are moments where it was used really effectively, like particularly when he kills his boss. Although... the film is pretty inconsistent over how... I don't understand how Deacon and his lot aren't... I know when he fully bursts in the full sunlight, they're wearing motorcycle jackets and helmets, which I think it's hilarious, by the way, that they can protect themselves from the sun with motorcycle helmets and sun cream. Because it's like, why don't they just go out all the time wearing sun cream? I don't really understand why they're not affected.
That's one of those moments where you're just like, okay, yeah, this is a screenwriter who I don't really... It's no surprise that I don't always warm to David S. Goyer's work when he's finding a way to have them face off in the street by just going, say he's wearing sun cream. And, yeah. and like you're talking about this enormous coincidence that happens, you know, that gets Blade and Deacon's stories to cross. Like, there's no... It's just like, oh, big coincidence that helps me out in the middle of the movie rather than laying these tracks a little bit more subtly or thinking a little bit harder about... how I can structure the first half of the film so it's not just a coincidence that makes it all come together.
I think it would be fair to say that this isn't the worst script that David Goyer's name is on, but it's far from the best. Yeah. But what it probably is it's an incredibly David Goyer script. Like it bears a lot of the things that I think you would characterise his work with.
Some of the dialogue is atrocious. It's like it's really, really bad. Some of the conversation. I mean, Kris Kristofferson gets saddled with a lot of it, and I, to be honest, for a lot of the time, I was surprised that he'd put up with that shit. and you, in terms of, I know what you mean about the film taking itself very seriously, but like it kind of like just flips between taking itself seriously and having fun. So the fact that Blade kind of signs off the movie by saying some motherfuckers are always trying to skate uphill. I skate uphill. That's a really funny line, and it's a great sign off in a way that a 90s action movie, like structured around a movie star, would tend to have those lines. But at the same time, it's completely out of place at that moment. I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It was like every so often someone would say to Wesley Snipes, like, "Hey, Wes, have some fun in this scene." You go, "Yeah, okay. Just this one, though, right?
Just this one. Scene, yeah."
Yeah. There's another. I'm just looking at the quotes. I mean, Donald Logue gets to say quite a lot of funny nonsense, like when he says, "I'm going to be naughty. I'm going to be a naughty vampire god." He might have been my MVP in this film. I really like Donald Logue. I am still, for my sins, I've gone back and I caught up with Gotham and I'm watching it and still not very good, but it is, it's at least entertaining because you never quite know what's going to come next. And like, you know, the worst of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is just a trudge. It's not out and out bad, but it's a trudge. But Donald Logue is consistently like my favourite part of that show, and I think he makes it watchable, and I think he made almost every scene he was in here watchable as well.
Most of them. Maybe not the very first one.
It's faint praise to say he made this film watchable.
It's faint praise from you, it's big praise from me. I love you, Donald Logue, and I think you were very good in this movie. He's always reliably scuzzy when he shows up, and I don't always appreciate him for that. You guys really didn't like this movie, did you? To the point where you're struggling to find things to say about it, good or bad. Is that fair?
I can see why people like it, and I can see that at the time that it came out, I can see why it had the effect that it did. It's just, it's so incredibly of its time. Like, it's a late 90s film that is best watched in the late 90s, and I just found it a slog.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's partly because I don't really like the genre anyway, but I just found it a slog to get through. It just wasn't much fun.
Yeah.
Apart from a few fleeting moments.
I don't think it's incompetent at what it's doing, but I just have no interest in what it's doing. Like, it's... You know, I didn't see it at the time, and that was when I was at the right age to go and watch it, so...
Whereas I will settle for enjoyable nonsense, so it's just about a thumbs up from me. I think I'll probably be trying to twist your guys' arms to get us to do Blade 2 anytime soon on the podcast.
We've got to say something for next Halloween.
Yeah, we do. And a little tease, we are going to be continuing with something slightly horror inflexed next time.
I didn't know if you wanted to spoiler that, but I will say that, yeah, the next thing that we're going to do is also in a genre that I'm not that keen on, but which is a film that, now I haven't rewatched it recently yet, but that I remember very much enjoying when I first saw it. So there's a little, you know, it's not all bad.
What a tease. I want to say what it is, but you've got to wait until the end of the podcast. Okay, guys, what have you? What comics are you going to recommend me based on Blade? I would be very surprised, based on what you've said already, if both of them feature the character of Blade. But we'll see.
Or if either of them feature the character of Blade. Yeah,
that might be more to the point.
Seb and I discussed this before, and I kind of feel duty bound to give you a Blade comic to read, just because, you know, that's why you're here, is to learn about comics, really. So. I'm going to recommend... In my entire life, I've only bought one issue of a comic with Blade's name on the front. And it is contained within this collection, which is Blade Undead Again by Mark Guggenheim and Howard Chaykin.
That is actually in the Marvel's Mightiest Heroes issue about Blade, by the way. So you could pick
always,
it up.
Always on the job.
Seriously, that is what they collected in Marvel's Mightiest Heroes.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why they would do that. It came out in 2007,
Must be like the third time we've done that, Seb. It must be a really good series that they're putting together.
It's really, really good, yeah.
Yeah, it's from 2007, so it's not completely influenced by the movies, but in coming after the movies, like, they did that thing of changing the character to be more like the more popular incarnation. Which, you know, to me, some people get really worked up about that, but to me it makes sense. And the reason I own this collection is because an issue from this collection is because issue 6 was a Civil War tie-in. So that'll be your first look at Civil War as well, in a way.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I should be excited about that or not, based on what you told me in the past.
It's very peripheral.
I'm intrigued. I'm definitely intrigued by Civil War. I'm sure I'm going to get around to reading the whole thing.
The other thing about this series, is that it's got a lot of Marvel Universe characters in, so you'll see Blade interacting with, like, Spider-Man and Doctor Doom and Wolverine and stuff. So in that sense, you know, it's a good introduction to Blade's context within the Marvel Universe. Like all Blade comics, it's tedious and was cancelled very quickly.
Excellent. Seb, have you got anything less tedious to recommend me?
Well, I think so, but it bears little to no actual direct relation to Blade. It's a DC comic.
What's the tenuous link that you've come up with to recommend me something that you like?
Okay, so this is actually a DC Vertigo comic. And it is called Welcome Back to the House of Mystery. And it is from, I think it's about 1998. I have it here so I can check.
The year that Blade was released.
Chop me looking it up. Actually, if it is the year that Blade was released, that makes quite a nice tie-in. So I will. It is. It's from July 98. Brilliant.
Wow, and you planned that ahead and everything, didn't you?
Can I go back and restart?
No, I want to leave it in like last week when we did with James.
All right.
Apparently one of the most entertaining moments in our podcast ever. So that's... We should just leave in all the mistakes from now on. I'm going to throw in some intentional ones.
You mean we weren't already? Yeah, so Welcome Back to the House of Mystery from 1998, which is basically a repackaged collection. It's got a new framing story by Neil Gaiman and the cartoonist Sergio Aragonés from Mad Magazine, who is brilliant. But it's a repackaging of various strips from the original House of Mystery comic that I mentioned earlier, and also Plop, which was another DC horror comic of the 70s. So Plop. It's just basic... Yeah, it was called Plop, seriously.
Wow. Well, he's trumped your recommendation, James.
It was a kind
like
of
a Norwegian
chocolate
bar.
Plop was a kind of humour horror type thing. It's Plop with an exclamation mark.
Of course it is.
God.
Actually, there is on the Wikipedia page, Sergio Aragonés tells the story of how they came up with the name. So you can go and read that. Anyway, so really, it's just it's a collection of these kind of short anthology horror stories, but the kind of horror twist in the tale type things. So it's just to kind of give you a sense of the type of stuff that was around in the way of horror comics in the 1970s that is the tradition that Blade kind of comes out of. Now, admittedly, these stories they're very similar in style to the kind of 1950s EC Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, and if you like these, you should go back and read those because they're even better. But these are all quite good takeoffs of that style of story, but with writers and artists who were some of them are recognisable as doing like superhero stuff for DC as well, like Neil Adams and Jim Aparo and stuff. But also, they're the kind of people who would be doing like horror type comics over at Marvel, like not exactly the same creators, but the same generation and type of creators. So. It's not the kind of story that Blade appeared in, but it's that 70s horror comics tradition that he comes from. So given that I can't recommend you anything directly about Blade, I might as well recommend you something that I know is good and is horror orientated, because we've never recommended you a horror comic before. So this is what horror comics are like, basically.
Excellent. Okay. We'll move on now to our final section, which is the pitch. And this week it's pretty simple. I'm going to, again, keep it horror theme for our Halloween special. I want me to pitch your ultimate superhero meets vampires movie. So this could be any current movie superhero, or just like any one that we haven't seen, but just like where a superhero is interacting with vampires on the big screen. And Seb, I'll come to you first.
Okay, so there's this teenage girl, and she has superpowers, and she lives in a town that's kind of situated on like a kind of gateway to hell. And so, like, in the town, there's all these vampires, and she has to go around and slay them using her powers.
It's very good, Seb, but you are also advocating a new Buffy movie. That's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. We saw the Buffy movie, and it didn't go very well. Weren't they trying to go ahead with a new Buffy movie, but without Joss Whedon? I'm pretty sure that's on the back burner somewhere. Well, Seb, you've advocated that. It's an open goal for James.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't call his idea bad until you've heard mine. Okay, so kind of my problem with this idea, right, is that it's one of the reasons that I kind of switch off whenever Dracula turns up in the Marvel Universe, is that vampires and superheroes are essentially like two different metaphors. Like, they don't work when you mash them together, because there's no like common ground between them. It's like when you try and cross over the Fantastic Four and X-Men. Like, notionally there's common ground, but there's nothing you can actually build a story on. And likewise, the same is true of vampires. Like, vampires aren't threatening if you can punch down a building. So when you mash together superheroes and vampires, you end up with something stupid, which is why I'm going to pitch Fantastic Four versus vampires. as the stupidest superhero idea I can think of.
You guys never respect my pitches. I can't make either of those.
It can't be worse than the last Fantastic Four film.
That's true. Maybe there were vampires in it. What if you know how, like, in Alias, Jessica Jones goes around and, like, experiences different corners of the Marvel Universe? What if there's just one, like, one episode of the new Jessica Jones show where she, like, she beats a vampire? What about that?
Yeah, but then you're like, well, why are there vampires hanging around in the superhero universe?
Just one. We never speak of it again. I feel like that's a better idea than both of yours.
If it was a mutant who had vampire-style powers and decided to model themselves on the vampire of legend.
I think the thing is, Joe.
Okay, I'm changing my pitch to that.
We know by now.
X-Men versus vampires.
Thing is, Joe, we know by now that whatever we suggest, you're just going to have your own pitch with.
Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, mine wasn't that good. I liked that. How does Spider-Man... So we never talked about Morbius in Spider-Man. How does he work? Like, because...
Badly.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Morbius isn't actually a vampire. He's a guy who experimented on himself and accidentally gave himself the exact powers of a vampire. Which is different, but fair, yeah.
If they were ever going to do vampires in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's the only way they could fit, because you don't have supernatural in the Marvel Cinematic Universe at the moment. So they would have to be Morbius, basically. Yeah. Well, we haven't seen him yet. We don't know exactly how his powers are going to work yet. So let's not count.
But aren't we expecting Dormammu, or was that not who you were telling me to probably expect as the villain?
Dormammu could be a bloke who's experimented on himself to give himself a flaming head. All right, no, they obviously are now going supernatural, but up to this,
they were hedging their bets.
You could
not
introduce vampires.
They're like, oh, it's not mystic; it's science.
Could Doctor Strange fight vampires on some weird astral plane?
He could, yeah.
All I want is you to take my pitches seriously.
All right, so how about Doctor Strange is on a plane and he fights vampires? That's what you just
suggested.
Vampires
on a plane?
Yeah.
Strange
is
on a plane.
The astral plane.
Yeah.
I'd watch that. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson could be in it.
You couldn't put Samuel L. Jackson in a Marvel film. That would be ridiculous.
I feel like what's just happened is that you've both made a mockery of this pitch section, and that I tried to save it, and it only got worse, and we've talked around the issue for a good 5 minutes now, and yes, established, my pitch was bad, and the answers are bad, and nobody wins here, not even the listeners. They've had to sit here and listen to it, and I apologise to everyone. We'll do much better next week. Nobody wins, no points. You're all grounded. Go to your rooms.
That seems fair.
Fantastic Four versus Zombies sparked 10 years. 10 years of Marvel Zombies comics. You can't tell me Fantastic Four versus Vampires isn't that good.
You've already told me that on the podcast, like at the start and again just now. No points for everyone. Okay. Right, well, if you're enjoying the show, listeners, then please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or Player FM or your podcast app of choice. And if you've already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or review, and we'll give you a shout out on a future show, I guess. You can find more episodes of I'll cheer up now. You can find more episodes of Cinematic Universe on cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, or as we're a Film Divider podcast, at filmdivider.com. You can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter, at @CU_podcast, or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. Happy Halloween, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Good night out there, whatever you are.
In the absence of light, darkness prevails. There are things that go bump in the night, Agent Myers. Make no mistake about that. And we are the ones who bump back. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Hellboy.